You are listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider on the official Raiders Podcast Network. Here's your host, Jerry Knapp.
Hello once again, Raider Nation. Welcome to Once a Raider, Always a Raider. I am your host, Jerry Knack, and I am joined once again by two-time Super Bowl champion head coach, former Raiders quarterback, Tom Flores. Tom, how are you this week?
I'm doing good. I'm just, kind of enjoying myself, enjoying the season, but I would enjoy it even more if we win. You know how that goes. Losing, I'll tell you, I think as you get older, it hurts more.
I tend to agree with you. And, you spend a lot of time yelling at the television as you watch these ball games. Recently, Coach, I wanted to talk to you about this. The Pro Football Hall of Fame announced the list of nominees for the class of 2019. Now, just to give your resume or refresh the Raider Nation with your resume a little bit, you have four rings,
yes.
Four Super Bowl rings. One as a player, mm-hmm. as a backup with the Kansas City Chiefs. As an assistant coach with the Oakland Raiders, Super Bowl 11, and two as a head coach, Super Bowl 15 and Super Bowl 18. I do believe you're the only person with four rings not in the Hall of Fame, and I think you're the only head coach with two Super Bowl rings not in the Hall of Fame, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, there's a couple others, but Seifert, I think, has two, and he took over for Bill Walsh across the bay from Oakland, and I'm not sure who the other one would be, but, it's a I certainly have enough silverware to qualify, and I would hope that at someday they'll realize that I've been part of history of professional football. When you think about it, I mean, there's a lot of history involved that I was part of, and for that I'm very proud, and for that I think I deserve to be on there. I'm not being braggadocious, overly braggadocious. But I'm just being brutally honest. I've been low-key a long time, and maybe it's time I started making some noise. I don't know. It seems like those guys get more attention.
Yeah, and maybe that quiet, stoic nature of yours kind of plays against you because you're not that way. You're very, very humble. You let your accomplishments speak for themselves. When you take a look at a lot of the other former Raiders who are not in the Hall of Fame, Cliff Branch and there's a long list. Lester Hayes, Jack Tatum. There's definitely a laundry list of guys we can make an argument for. I always like to look at the contemporaries, right? So, when you look at Kenny Stabler went in, you look at his contemporaries, there was one guy that had better numbers than him, and that was Terry Bradshaw. And Bradshaw was in the Hall of Fame. He had better numbers than Bob Greasy and a whole host of other quarterbacks that played at that time. He lost out the 76 MVP to Burt Jones, which I still don't understand that one. Jones was a good quarterback, but, mm-hmm. Kenny had just as good a year in 76 as he did in 74 when he won the MVP then. So you look at Cliff, and there's only one other player really that compares to him from his time frame, and that's John Stallworth. And Stallworth is in the Hall of Fame, so why not Cliff? Cliff has three Super Bowl championships under his belt. So in your case, you kind of look at your contemporaries, and I'm looking at who else is nominated with you in the coach category for the class of 2019. You have Don Coryell, who you are very, very familiar with,
yep.
and had a winning record against. Bill Cowher of the Pittsburgh Steelers, Jim Hanifin, Mike Holmgren, Jimmy Johnson, Richie Pettibone, Dan Reeves, Marty Schottenheimer, Clark Shaughnessy, and Dick Vermeil, somebody else you are very, very familiar with. All of these gentlemen had long, storied careers as head coaches. There's a lot of championships in this group right here. But from a total career standpoint, player and coach, I don't think there's anybody in this group that has your credentials.
Well, I'd have to agree. And I coached against, I know almost all these guys. Murray Schottenheimer and I were teammates in Buffalo, and we became close friends and still are close friends. We get together every year. He visits the desert once in a while, and we meet back east sometimes. And anyway, I've watched his career. I followed his career. Dick Vermeil and I were contemporaries in college. He went to San Jose State. I went to College of Pacific, and that was our big rivalry. So we faced each other twice a year, not twice a year, but 2 years back to back. He was a quarterback. I was a quarterback. And lo and behold, here we are in the Super Bowl, Super Bowl 15. He's the head coach. I'm the head coach. So it was kind of, it was nice to see. It was fun to see. And it was a fun competing against Dick because he was an outstanding coach and a very, you talk about a serious-minded coach. He was really serious-minded, more so than I am.
Yeah, you know, the stories out of New Orleans, you know, that week, a lot of people were saying, you know, Philadelphia was buttoned up. They had real strict rules and curfew, and that you guys were a little more loosey-goosey. Now, obviously, the legend is greater than the truth. We've talked about it on numerous occasions that there was only really one incident with Matuszak out after curfew. But it still seemed like the Raiders were looser that week and looser going into the game than the Philadelphia Eagles.
Well, we treated it tried to treat it like any other week. In spite of the enormous value and popularity of that game and the pressure that was on and how it became bigger than life, but you still try to not get your players too uptight. You still try to give them the same kind of freedom that they had when we were at home. And Dick went back to like a training camp situation. He went back and almost, I'm surprised they weren't having two-a-days. But, sequestered them, and our guys were out for dinner on their own. So there were a lot of things that we did that were just the way that we were. That's the way we did. That's the way John Madden did it before me in Super Bowl 11. So, I mean, it wasn't a big thing for us, but it became a big thing for the press and for Dick Vermeil. And then when John Matuszak was caught out and the headlines on that, Vermeil said he would have sent his guys home had they done that. I wasn't going to send anybody home because they were all part of it.
Yeah, and, I still love the story with Matuszak and his excuse. He's out on Bourbon Street collecting the rookies, making sure they don't get in trouble.
I wanted to make sure everybody was in for curfew, Coach. I looked up at him, I should say. He was 6'7", and I was trying not to laugh a little bit. I said, just get out of here. Go to your meeting. I find him, and we went on from there, and we played – a marvelous game, and we made no mistakes or very few mistakes, and the Eagles made all of them.
This is true. Ron Jaworski threw three interceptions to Rod Martin in that game, obviously.
Yeah.
Your good friend and longtime quarterback, Jim Plunkett, was the MVP of that game, the Cinderella story, the comeback for the ages that year. After a lot of people had given up on Jim and he'd come off the bench that year. As far as Dick Vermeil was concerned, when you guys obviously had to have talked either during the week or pregame, just kind of a shake hands, good luck kind of thing, were you guys really aware, you guys played in college. Did you reflect on that at all? Like, wow, look at us. We've come from College of the Pacific and San Jose State, and now here we are coaching in the Super Bowl.
No, you don't think about it that time. I mean, at that time, it's just what's the topic at hand, and the topic at hand was that game. We didn't socialize, didn't have time. He lived on the East Coast, I was on the West Coast, and even though we were from California, so it was more of a professional courtesy type of thing before a game. You don't talk about too much of the things, little. Insipid things that, how you doing? Fine, blah, blah, blah. And, but I didn't really think about it until later. You don't think about a lot of things like that until later when you're reflecting on this thing that you just won, which is the Super Bowl and how big it is. And then you start thinking about all the little things that led up to it. And you go back even to your high school, you go back to your junior high, go back to the grape fields in the San Joaquin Valley and picking grapes. Like Sam Bogosian, my line coach, he and I were from the same area, the San Joaquin Valley, and we grew up similar. He worked in the farms, I worked in the farms, and when we're winding down that game, there's very little time left on the clock, and we realized we were the champs. And he came up to me. He said, "Not bad for a couple of grape pickers, huh?" And I said, "Yeah." We had big smiles on our face, and then you start reflecting.
That's quite the story, especially, you know, you get to share it with somebody who had the similar background to yours as well. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Raiders on this list, a few of them anyway. And most of them, I don't think you coached any of them, but they were guys that you watched during your radio career and got to see play week in and week out and be around during training camp or when you'd visit to do your research for the team. Steve Wisniewski, what comes to mind when you hear the name Steve Wisniewski and remember what kind of player he was?
Well, Steve was a tough competitor. I mean, he was in some ways classified by other teams as a dirty guy because he'd knock your head off and then probably bless you at the same time because he was, I don't know if he swore at all, but he became a preacher later and was very religious in that respect. But boy, on the football field, it was like Jekyll and Hyde, and other players didn't like to go against him because he went to the whistle blew. I mean, he wasn't a cheap shot guy, but he was nasty in his approach to it and never backed off. He was tenacious. He was really a good Raider. He typified the standards for offense and defensive linemen.
Yeah, I had got to see Steve play my first couple of years with the organization, and on top of that too, Steve, he's just a quality guy.
Yeah, you would never. I mean, if you talk to him, you'd think, "Well, who's this guy? Who's this little, line up for high tea in the afternoon or something?"
Well, the funny thing is, we never talked about football.
No,
even in the locker room, I'd be doing interviews, doing whatever. We never talked about football when we exchanged pleasantries. It was always, "How's your family? How's mm-hmm. everybody doing?"
Yeah.
Leroy Glover did not play here very long, but he was here for one season and played two games for the Raiders and went on to a stellar career with the Saints and the Cowboys. What do you recall about Leroy Glover just in your travels?
Well, I didn't know him very well. I met him once, I wouldn't recognize him if I saw him on the street. But when he turned it on, boy, he could turn it on. I mean, he could really play the game. And you wonder, why didn't he do that here? And he would have never gotten out the door if he had played that well here because he was a good football player. And he did make a lot of plays, but I don't really know him well enough to comment that much on him.
Russell Maryland came over from the Dallas Cowboys, and he had several productive years here with the Raiders. Very stout fireplug of a defensive tackle, and so he's one of the nominees at defensive lineman. What do you remember of Russell Maryland?
Well, I remember him. I actually remember him when he was in college because at that point I was up in Seattle, and we were studying the draft, and he and a guy named Cortez Kennedy played side by side on defense, and we loved Cortez Kennedy, and we also loved Russell Maryland, but Cortez was a little step above him, and we took Cortez, and Cortez is in the Hall right now, and was a great, great player. God rest his soul. Unfortunately, we lost him not too long ago, but Russell was in that category, just a stout, made a lot of plays. You didn't go in the middle of the field. You didn't run in the middle of the field too much when you played against guys like that.
Richard Seymour, defensive lineman, made his bones really with the New England Patriots, but came over in a trade and played with the Raiders for a little while. What can you say about Richard Seymour?
Well, Richard was, I think by the time he got to us, he didn't have it all. When he played well, but he didn't have enough left in his tank. To give us everything because when he was at his peak, he could make plays. Boy, he was a true playmaker, but he only did that in a few games here for us.
Taking a look at the defensive backs, there's two on this list that spent some time here with the Raiders. Also a couple of guys who spent the first half of their career with another team. Eric Allen, who came over from the Philadelphia Eagles, and Albert Lewis, who came over from the Kansas City Chiefs, two guys who were well-regarded as really good cover corners during their careers. Not quite shut down, but very, very good cover corners. A lot of turnovers between the two of them during their careers.
Yeah, well, I remember Eric. I remember both of them well. Eric Allen is always – he was very smooth, very classy guy, very cerebral in his own way. You know, defensive players, most of them are just wild and crazy guys. But he was more cerebral, very eloquent in his, you know, in his mannerisms. Albert Lewis was a little more of a wild guy in his play. I didn't know him personally. I got to know Eric personally when he came here. I didn't know Albert that well personally, but I really respected him because he was one of the guys that you didn't want to tempt him too much. You didn't want to go over there too much because sooner or later he's going to pick one off.
He was very physical as a corner too. He'd jam you at the line of scrimmage, and you know, he very, very good ball skills. Both those players, very good ball skills.
Ball skills, you know, and the rules were different then too. You couldn't bump. You could bump down the field. You could play tight coverage. You could maul a guy if you wanted to at the line of scrimmage. But you know, a la Willie Brown, that was his style when he played.
Well, we're going to get into a guy real quick before we change topics here. I want to talk to you a little bit about Lester Hayes. You mentioned him a little while ago. And my question for you is, do you think that Lester gets the 1980 season almost held against him? Like, he had this unbelievable season. He had 13 interceptions in regular season, tied an NFL record. He had five more called back. He had several in the playoffs that year on your Super Bowl run. It just seems to me that people forget the other years that he had and say, well, he was a one-hit wonder. He had one good year. He's not Hall of Fame worthy. What would you say is an argument against that?
Well, I would say that if he played on the East Coast, he'd be in the Hall of Fame right now. I mean, you don't do that on the field. You don't have that kind of statistics in your record book to not become a Pro Bowl, a Hall of Fame candidate. The fact that he wasn't going to do that every year, that was a magical year for him. But still, he was consistent every year, and you got to look at a play and look what he did. But Lester is a very quiet guy, and kind of disappeared. You don't see him too often anymore. We see him more than most people. He wasn't on television. You didn't see him on ESPN. And see a lot of this. I think a lot of this. It's not a prejudice, but it's just, I mean, it happens. Guys are on television. They see them on television. And then they don't forget them. The ones that aren't on television that have done just the same thing, they forget about this. Oh, yeah, he did. If you had put Stabler in New York and played in New York like Joe Namath did, he would have been in the Hall of Fame 10, 15 years ago. I mean, what did Joe Namath do that Kenny Stabler didn't do? That's one of my arguments. And, you know, the Pittsburgh Steelers, they put almost all of them, except the water boy, maybe the field manager, in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, with all due respect to Lynn Swann, Cliff Branch's playoff records are much better. And but he's not on TV. He's not, you know, he doesn't do all that. So it becomes kind of a popularity contest, too, I think.
Well, Cliff, to this day, is still number three all-time in playoff receiving yardage, which it's amazing that, especially in today's pass-happy NFL, and with teams like the Patriots and the Steelers and even like the Ravens that are perennial playoff contenders, the Denver Broncos and some of these Charger teams we've seen in the last 20 years, you know, that throw the ball 40, 50 times a game, that Cliff is still number three all-time in receiving yards in the playoffs.
Yeah, and this is a passing league now, too. You have to realize that. This is it's not like it used to be where you'd run, you know, a little bit more balanced, but, you know, it's a passing league now, you know, and some of the guys that can throw now, wow, they come out of college throwing the ball very well. The kid at Kansas City, I mean, Mahomes, what a way to start the season. But some of us old-timers, we did a lot of the same similar things. I threw five touchdowns one week and came back and threw six the following week. So that was 11 in two games. But who cares, right? That happened in the 60s.
I care, Tom. I care. Yeah. You're listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider. I'm your host, Jerry Nack, and I'm joined by two-time Super Bowl champion head coach Tom Flores. Tom, I want to change gears with the Raiders taking on the Cleveland Browns this season. You were the head coach in one of the most memorable games, and not only in Oakland Raiders history, but also NFL history. And it was freezing cold. It was Sunday, January 4th, 1981. You had just beaten the Houston Oilers and former Raiders quarterback Kenny Stabler and Jack Tatum and Dave Casper in the wild card round in Oakland, and you had to go to Cleveland. And it's January. If anybody out there knows anything about that part of the world in January, it's flipping cold.
Yeah, I spent a couple of years in Buffalo as a player, and I know what cold is when you play in Buffalo right off the same lake, Lake Erie. And it was we knew it was going to be cold. We came in early for that game, and we almost had we not had a bigger plane for that game, we would have probably had to land in some other area and spend the night there before we got to Cleveland. But we had a bigger plane that was able to accommodate us and land. And all week long, the talk was that the California team is going to be freezing and they're going to do this, they're going to do that. Well, we had a workout, you know, and outside, and where the Browns, they went indoors to work out the day before the game. Our guys, instead of being cold, they had snow fights. They build snowmen. Yeah, you guys, do you mind if can we practice now? Okay, so we went through our normal ritual, and knowing that that was just a taste, because the next day was going to be really cold, and we knew that. We got to the stadium, and walked out on the field, and it was frozen. I said, "Oh boy!" And that I when I say football field, I'm being nice, because that was a pit hole, that the old stadium, and that,
the mistake was, by the lake.
Oh man, it was. I went down. I was going to tap a piece of sod that was sticking up, and I almost broke my foot because it was solid ice. I said, "Oh, this is not good. This is not good." Our guys were out there in t-shirts. Some of them, Dave Dalby was out in t-shirts saying hello to one of his buddies that played for the Browns, and they were all bundled up. And but there were a lot of things that led up to that game that were kind of funny now that you look back at them. But at that time, they were, you know, we gave them some serious thought at how to handle this game.
Well, I grew up in Rochester, New York, and spent part of my military career in Iceland, so I know the cold that you're talking about. According to the box score I have in my hand, it was 2 degrees with 21-mile-per-hour winds and a wind chill of minus 20, but I have heard that it was worse than that.
Yes. Yeah, the wind chill, was, I think, 39 below at some point during that game, and trust me, it was, because I was chewing gum, and when I was on the sideline, I was chewing gum, and all the way home that day, after that night after the game, my jaw was killing me. I said, "God Almighty, I got a toothache," and I didn't realize that the gum had frozen, and I was still gnawing on that gum as if it was nice and soft, and for the most of the game, I said, "Oh my God, that's what it's from." It took me half of the way home to thaw out. It was so cold. It was just, I don't know how our players did it, but they did it.
Yeah, they sure did. So let's go through the game a little bit. Well, the setup, we talked about it before we started. They were known as the Cardiac Kids that year. Brian Sipe had a fantastic year for the Browns, but these guys were winning games they had no business winning, the last-second victories, and you know they get this affectionate nickname, the Cardiac Kids. And how much of that were you aware of going into the game, or were you just guys locked in film study and all that stuff and weren't really worried about how they were, you know, the last-second victories? You were just worried about the players on the other side.
Well, had we been playing at home, I would have thought differently about it. But since they did, a lot of that stuff was done at their house, you have to take that into consideration. When I looked at them team for team, I thought at that point of the year we had peaked. Our defense was really playing well, and our offense was so well balanced with Branch and Bobby Chandler and Plunkett having the comeback year that he had, and Mark Van Egan, and you know, we were a pretty good football team, Kenny King. But so you had to take into consideration this team is hot, and they got hot, and they can get hot, so don't take them lightly. So we never took them lightly, and we had to take all the considerations into our game plan, including the weather, and that was a big factor in how we approached it. That was a big factor in how I approached it, because I knew that we were the one end in the field towards the lake would be frozen in the second half, at least for sure in the fourth quarter, and. So when we came out at halftime, we had the choice, and I chose to defend so we wouldn't be going that way, because I felt this game's going to be decided by probably a field goal.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the Browns get on the board first in the second quarter. Ron Bolton grabs a pick six off of Jim Plunkett, and they miss the extra point. It's 6-0. Then you guys, before halftime, Mark Van Egan goes in from a yard out. Chris Barr makes the extra point. 7-6 at halftime now. And going in the third quarter, Don Cockcroft makes 2 30-yard field goals to give the Browns a 12-7 lead. But you were just saying in the fourth quarter, the kicking, you thought it would come down to a field goal, but also that the field was going to be a factor in the kicking game as well.
Yes. Yeah, I did. I said it's going to be hard for kickers to get the ball up in the air or plant their plant foot. So it's not going to be a very secure kick. It's going to be a little tentative.
Now, Lester had 2 interceptions in this game as well. Was there something you guys saw from Brian Sipe that you felt like, you know, you could get some turnovers from him?
Well, Brian had a hot year. He had a, you know, MVP type of year, but he didn't have a real strong arm. And guys that don't have strong arms, especially in cold weather, the ball hangs a little longer. Lester was having a marvelous career, a marvelous year, and had already picked off a lot of balls during the course of the normal season, and had a lot of confidence in himself. And we played a lot of man-to-man, and Lester was able Lester was a lot smarter than people gave him credit for. He used to study a lot, and a lot of his interceptions were because he had anticipated and, it would take that little chance that the ball was coming this way, and most of the time he was right.
Cleveland gets a ball late in the game after you guys take the lead 14-12, and they're driving, and they cross the 50-yard line. Sam Ratigliano makes a decision, and he's looking at his kicking game. He's looking at Cockcroft. And missed an extra point. Weather conditions are what they are. He makes a fateful decision. We're going to throw the ball one more time, and we're going to try to win this thing on the arm of Brian Sipe. And Hall of Fame tight end Ozzie Newsome, and the odds are pretty good here, right, that they could make a play. But we call the game Red Right 88 because in the play call, Ratigliano utters that phrase. And Mike Davis undercuts the route on a throw to Ozzie Newsome in the end zone and secures the victory. Now take me through that whole thing. And also, look at it from Ratigliano's standpoint, too. As a head coach, the agonizing decision that had to be made there.
Yeah, you don't have a lot of time to make these decisions. And Sam, I could just see what was going through his mind. I don't blame him for the call. I don't blame him at all. Listen, they had gotten there, as you mentioned, as the cardiac kids. They were winning games by making plays late in the fourth quarter, right at the end of the game, whether it's a pass or a kick or whatever. So I could just see Sam going through his mind. He said, "We got we're gonna." I think it was third down when they did it, or whatever it was, we can kick the ball, but not now. Let's go for the red right 88, and go to our primary receiver, which was our tight end, our future Hall of Famer, who was a sure thing if the ball got to him. and going against their probably worst defender as far as the pass is concerned, because Mike Davis couldn't catch a cold, even in 39 below chill factor. And maybe that was a clue. He couldn't feel the ball when he got it, and that's why he intercepted it. So they go to that. They go to the crossing route, and Mike undercut the throw and perfect. I mean, he just – you couldn't look any better than the ball looked. Of course, it was, I call it the million-dollar catch. When he caught that ball, we went berserk, and because the game was over.
Yeah, and you know, like you said, you know, Mike Davis couldn't catch. It seems like the guys named Davis who weren't supposed to be able to catch anything make two of the biggest catches in Raiders history, because apparently Clarence Davis couldn't catch either, and he caught the Sea of Hands play against Miami in 74, and now Mike Davis in 1980 against the Cleveland Browns. Obviously, after that, you guys go on to the AFC Championship game against the San Diego Chargers, win that in a spectacular game there, hold off a furious comeback from the Chargers, go on to win the Super Bowl against the Philadelphia Eagles and your contemporary and former college opponent, Dick Vermeil. And Dick was able to reinvent himself and come back after a career in broadcasting, win a Super Bowl with the then St. Louis Rams. It's really interesting because I remember watching this game on television and just, you know, you jump through the ceiling when Mike Davis makes this play. So I can only imagine what you guys were going through on the sidelines. Looking back on it, even though you were on the winning side, when you look at, you know, like you said a second ago, you don't begrudge Rattigliano making that decision. On some level, do you feel for him a little bit, just a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit, because losing, you know, he had a good career, but he's always going to be remembered. Think about it. I mean, what is he remembered for? He's not remembered for the marvelous seasons they had, you know, for taking that team that far and for coaching in Cleveland. That in itself is an accomplishment under those conditions. And he's remembered for Red Right 88. And why did you call it? And they don't remember for the other Red Right 88s that he called during that season to get to that point where they had a chance. And they were favored in the game, and rightfully so. They were playing at home under the cold conditions, and they were on a hot streak. We were on a hot streak too, but we were playing on the West Coast, and we didn't get as much attention as they did.
Right, and you know, they're fans, and they're great fans there in Cleveland.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they, during that time, from that point on, like throughout the 80s, I think people forget how good the Cleveland Browns were in the 80s with the great teams that they had. They were playing in AFC Championship games, and, you know, this kind of was the start of that ascension of the Browns as an AFC team to be reckoned with.
Yeah, because Marty Schottenheimer took over and he had a great career there. But the problem with Marty was that he got to the playoffs, and that's where it usually ended. Usually bad things happened to him in the playoffs, like the fumble. Can't remember the name of the running
back. It was Keith.
Anyway, it was the running
Ernest
back.
Ernest Biner, wasn't
Ernest
it?
Ernest Biner, yeah, fumbled. Here, the guy that very rarely fumbled. He fumbles going in the end zone for the winning score. And then Elway on one game taking the ball and going 95 yards like Elway liked to do, and performing his magic. And so And then Marty goes to San Diego. This sounds like a pep talk for Marty Schottenheimer, but Marty's a good friend of mine. I really enjoy him a lot. And
I noticed you skipped over the years he coached the Chiefs.
Yeah.
He went right to San Diego.
Well, San Diego, yeah. Chiefs are a different story because I played 2 years for – I got my first ring with the Chiefs, so I kind of don't talk about them when I have to.
Well, anything else stand out from that other than, you know, won the game, went to the AFC Championship? Anything else stand out about that week or that game? Anything? You know, I mean, offense was hard to come by. Plunkett went 14-30 for 149, threw two interceptions. Sipe was 13-40 for 183 and three interceptions. Neither team could really run the ball. Van Egan ran for 45, Kenny King 23 on the other side. Mike Pruitt had 48, Calvin Hill had 23. Calvin had come over from the Dallas Cowboys. You know, Greg Pruitt only carried the ball four times for 11 yards. So it looked like offense was few and far between here.
Well, we knew, and you know, when you're going into a game like that, you know that it's going to be tough to throw because it was tough for the guys to run routes. And your quarterback's all, you know, it's cold, and it's a cold football, and hard to throw a ball like that. And so you want to feature the running game, but when the team gangs up on you in the running game, you know, the field wasn't that stable anyway, because as far as traction is concerned. So offensively, the defense has the advantage in a game like that. Offensively, it was going to be. That's why I felt this is going to be a tight football game, and turnovers were a big factor as well.
Yeah, they were, and I think what goes lost here is Ray Guy and Johnny Evans punted the ball 17 times, and Evans even was able to manage to log a 61-yard punt in this game, and to be like kicking a rock.
Yeah, yeah, you got to admire those guys. You got to admire the guy, the kickers. You got to admire them all because they were all out there playing, and you know, we had played the last game of the year. This was a little insight. We had played the last game of the year in New York, played against the Giants, and we won that game. And during that game, they had these heated seats on the sideline. So we were able to use the seats ourselves, and they were really helpful as far as keeping the players from freezing. So we had those seats shipped to Cleveland. And because we had those seats shipped to Cleveland, we had to provide the visiting team had to provide the same thing for the Browns, and they had nothing to do with them early in the game. But pretty soon you looked over and they had found out those seats were pretty good, so they were sitting on the seats, staying relatively warm, but still you had to go out and play under the conditions. It was not easy.
Well, I would think that, yeah, they would eventually find the heated seats and reap the benefits there. Well, and it's funny you say that because, you know, you see that all the time with, like, headsets. If one team's headsets go out, the other team has to stop using the headsets. So, yeah, that's really interesting. That has to be same for each team.
Yeah. Doesn't matter whether you're visiting or home. It's if you're the visiting team and you have something the home team doesn't have, then you have to supply it, which was the case then.
See, I did not know that part.
Ah, there you go.
See, you learn something new every day and every week when Tom Flores is on the Once a Raider, Always a Raider podcast. So just kind of a little bit of housekeeping here about the Hall of Fame. Tom obviously is a finalist for the class of 2019 for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and there is going to be a fan vote. You can vote for your favorite Pro Football Hall of Fame nominee. You should visit www.nfl.com/HOFvote to make your pick. And also, you can find out who is going to make the class of 2019 the weekend of the Super Bowl, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
I'm
the night before,
The selection committee will meet on Saturday, February 2nd, 2019, in Atlanta, Georgia, to elect the class of 2019. There is no set number of enshrinees, but there will be at least 4 and 8 new members selected. And, of course, there's the senior finalist and contributor category. I'm not, you know, not saying you're old or anything, but, you know, what is the rule for the senior committee? How long do you have to be retired or out of the game for that?
I think you have to be out of the game 25 years, you know, before you qualify under that. I think that's how John Madden got in, and Hank Stram, and people of that, you know.
Isn't that how Ray Guy got in? Wasn't he a senior?
I don't know if that's
I think Ray was also a senior committee nominee.
Yeah, you know, that's a Dick LeBeau got in, first assistant coach to get in the hall, and that's why you see Hanifin this year, because now they're going and realizing how important coaching is, and some of these assistants that have been in the game for a long time and been a big contributor, certainly why shouldn't they qualify?
Right. And I said it in our first episode, in the premiere of this podcast, is, you know, I'm going to steal this, but I can't take credit for it. I can't remember who said it. The measure of somebody to go into the Hall of Fame, can you tell the story of pro football without this person? And if you can't, that person belongs in the Hall of Fame. Lester, you can't tell the story of pro football without Lester Hayes. The stick'em, the pre-snap stance that he would take, the interceptions, the personality. Cliff Branch, you can't tell the story of pro football without him. But most certainly, you can't tell the story of pro football without Tom Flores.
Well, I appreciate that. And from a kind of a very modest position. I agree.
Oh, that sounds like a good note to end this podcast on. So that's going to do it for this edition of Once a Raider, Always a Raider. I'd like to thank two-time Super Bowl winning head coach, one-time assistant coach, and one-time player winning Super Bowl winning Tom Flores for being my guest on the show once again, and we'll have you back again real soon.
I hope so. Anytime.
Well, Raider Nation, that's going to do it. We will talk to you next time, and go Raiders.
Thank you for listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider on the official Raiders Podcast Network.